This is Kate Scott Allen of OTCO.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com. Welcome to Hurting Code. We're being recorded from a secret location on February 24th, 2010. Our guest this week is Barry Dorans, former Microsoft Most Valuable Professional in the security realm, now Blue Badge, still in security, but now he has a legal keyboard.
Well, I have a keyboard that has an American keyboard layout, which is confusing. Heck, I do.
You know, I think that is the number one complaint of brand new UK Blue Badges, is that they're like, where can I get a UK keyboard?
I brought one with me.
Is it the whole drive on the left, drive on the right side of...
Hey, don't laugh. I killed the hire car last week by crashing it. No, it's the fact that your enter keys are too small. You know, I thought everything was supposed to be bigger in America. And
it's not the size of the enter key. It's how you use it.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You keep trying to convince yourself of that.
So, as a side note, if by the end of this podcast we haven't scared the bejesus out of you and caused you to unplug and turn off your computer, then I don't think we've done our job in getting Barry to talk about security. Because every time I talk to him, I'm ready to go live in Montana on a ranch. Just cool. So I'll be safe.
Well, you know, if we want to scare people, we can just put a picture of John up on the website.
That's a great idea.
Thanks to Google Buzz, every one of my Google search results now has a picture of John Galloway on it.
See, that's why I'm glad I disabled Buzz. Not just for the privacy aspects, but the fact that anyone could put John Galloway on my screen? No. That's just wrong on so many different levels.
I'll find some other way to get on your screen, Barry.
Oh, that's just horrible. Thank you.
He'll keep sending you inter-office messages, and he'll make sure his contact info pops up.
Just if you get an email with an attachment of .scr, just open it. Just go ahead.
The John Galloway screensaver. Hold on, you're telling me to double-click on attachments and emails from strange people that I don't know or trust?
I'm not that. I hope you trust me a little bit.
Well, it's coming from a Microsoft address, right? So it's safe.
By default.
Bill Gates sent me $10 once.
Wow, really?
No.
No. He wants my MSN Messenger address because apparently I can win a prize with that. And then there's the Microsoft lottery. But yes.
So give us a little bit of your background. Like what got you started in... Oh, wait. Do we want to go down the what got you started in computing history? Perhaps not.
Well, we could do, but it probably won't mean a lot to you guys because, of course, you know, back in the early 80s, the computers that we had were different to yours. So I started off on what was known in the UK as a ZX Spectrum, and I think you had it as a Timex Sinclair. I can't remember what the US thing
Indeed.
Was.
But
this thing
the
had
tiny
a,
little membrane keyboard.
Yeah, the dead flesh keyboard. Because that's what it felt like. Apparently, I don't know, I've not touched dead flesh. I would like to make this perfectly clear, just in case the Department of Homeland Security is listening, because, hey, you know, I have a visa and they can take it away. I have never touched dead flesh.
So I have. That's what it feels like.
Oh, I don't even want to know. So I started off on one of those. And like everyone else of that age, you managed to con your parents into saying this would be educational. And then the first thing you did was you started copying games. I'm playing. But my best friend at the time also had a computer, although that was a BBC B, which you guys never got. And we just started challenging each other to try and make our computers do things. And that's where it all kicked off, really. And that's it. I mean, from that, going from BASIC through, let's see, more BASIC eventually, going on to Quick BASIC in the PC with dalliances in Pascal, COBOL, RPG3, C, C++, Visual C++, Visual BASIC, then VB Script for ASP, then going back to C# for ASP.NET because that made me feel like a real programmer again after having to use VB Script. And now I am where I am.
God bless you, Barry, for that brief history. So how did you get interested in security specifically? Because that's primarily how I know you. You've got a book out. I think you have, what, there's like you and Michael Howard are the only ones that have security books out for the platform.
There's more people that have done that. And so Brian Sullivan would not forgive me if I didn't mention he has one, but that's mostly focused on JavaScript and Ajax. And Dominic Bayer has one that's a little bit old now. That was probably the original "Let's show you how to secure .NET." I mean, Michael's stuff was generic. It's wonderful, but it didn't really touch upon platforms. So the whole writing secure code bits and pieces is just it's a style and a process and a way of thinking, but not so nitty gritty, if you know what I mean. And there's Windows Snyder and a bunch of other people. I mean, a lot of the security books that came out of Microsoft Press were absolutely wonderful. But yes, I have the most recent one. We shall put it like that. And it's not out in the US yet. I think it's out in a couple more weeks. So it came out in the UK just before Valentine's Day, and I was desperately trying to convince everyone that it would make an ideal Valentine's present for their wife. I don't think anyone did it.
No, there was some kind of shortage because they said that there was a bunch of burnings in the UK.
Yeah, they were all rather mean. So my last... Well, the UK has a really strong... .NET community, a bunch of tight little knit, no, that's not right, a tightly knit bunch, that was it. And so we run a conference every 6 months called Developer, Developer, Developer. I can't think where that came from. And we honestly didn't show that video now that I'm employed. So that's sponsored by Microsoft, but we don't allow Microsoft people to speak. So it's just community speakers. So it started off, we gave away all the places. I think the first one probably took a couple of weeks for all the places to go. And the last one, all the places went in 14 minutes. So it's extremely popular. So I had the last session of the day, which, you know, automatically makes you suspicious. So I thought, right, well, you know, I'm prepared. They're going to do something, and it will be after the presentation. Unfortunately not. Every 10 minutes through my presentation, they would take over the screen. They would take control away of the keyboard, and they just play little vignettes, little films, basically saying goodbye in probably the most insulting way that they could. And everyone, apparently, had a slide with my book cover, every other speaker, and they would just... you know, take piss. So it was lovely. One of those adverts was a fake book burning. Yes. And I will say no more about that because it's really embarrassing.
So there's like a ton of things to cover. we may be here all night.
I should go get another beer.
So the thing about security is, it seems to me, is the most important aspect of any public-facing website, for sure, or any kind of public web service. But it seems like it gets the least amount of attention. I can think of one project where we had like a professional firm come in and audit our site for security before we launched.
Did you have credit cards involved in that? Because that's generally the reason people get audited. Yes, you get your PCI compliance. Whereas everything else just falls by the wayside. It's weird. I think part of the problem is, well, you're not aware of the problem until things go wrong, despite sitting there and reading about all the credit card hacks and, you know, identity theft that's prevalent throughout the world today. But everyone has an attitude of it won't happen to me. And I think part of that is an educational thing. It's something that's not taught at all, be it in universities or be it in development courses. The only way you get security training is to go to a specific security course, unfortunately, which has always struck me as a bit wrong. You know, if you're learning how to write websites, well, security should be part of that. It shouldn't just be this add-on training session that you go to 6 months later because somebody's decided you need a little bit of security training. It should be baked in from the ground up. And I don't think anybody really does a good job of doing that at all.
Now, part of the way Scott asked the question is the way that most people run into this is in terms of a security audit. And it sounds like that's part of the problem, too. Like, it's baked on not only in terms of developer training, but also in terms of project. Like, okay, we built this site, now let's do a security audit, as opposed to starting off thinking about security.
Yeah, indeed. And To be fair, Microsoft have made leaps and bounds in this. So the secure development lifecycle actually starts at the very beginning as part of the specifications. You have a security specification, and it's usually a little bit more than this has to be secure. So I'm probably not the right person to talk to about this. There are people who are far better at explaining the SDL than I, and I probably would get it wrong if I tried to go into the various details of it. But baking that in from the design, from making sure that both the business and developers know that it must be part and parcel of your deliverables, and then going through a formal process of modeling threats against whatever you're developing, so you know what the problems are. And then as you mitigate against them, you can take them off your feature or bug list. So they're there throughout the development cycle. And that's a continuous thing. So the next iteration, you start again, and you're threat modeling against the new things that you're going to develop. And again, it goes, it's there all the way throughout the iteration. And if anything has gone wrong, then the lessons learned from that are fed into the next iteration. Which is also important because, it's all very well saying, well, I'm going to model my threats, but that's kind of hard to do. You hear some security professionals saying, oh, well, you need to think like a hacker. And that's not a statement I agree with, because that's like me handing a large knife to Scott Kuhn over there and saying, think like a chef. It doesn't work like that. He'd probably just want to stab someone with it. But you cannot think like a hacker unless you've done it. But what you can do is you can think about what the risks are to your application. So what happens if this goes wrong? What happens if I leak this information? What happens if there is a cross-site scripting attack, even if you have to go read the first time what that is? So the threat modeling process allows you to make sure that you're covering as much as possible, and that's now mandatory for certainly all the Microsoft product development and a lot of the internal tools as well. And it's been responsible for cutting down an awful lot of security bugs. I mean, you can see it from the Vista reset onwards. The amount of security bugs has gone down at a rate of knots.
So a lot of times they'll try to bake in security. So people will think that as long as they use named parameters that they're safe from any SQL injection, and that's an automatic kind of salve that they can put over their app, or as long as they're HTML encoding everything, it's just going to be perfect.
Yes.
Or if they just only require post on AJAX, calls to controllers, things like that. Is there a checklist that you should go down with any app? Let's say with any web app, because it's going to be different for client versus a service API that's public and things like that.
So there's an organization called OWASP. OWASP.
Are they the ones that have the GOAT tool?
WebGoat. Yes. WebGoat.
Yeah.
They do. Yes, they have the GOAT tool.
And see, I know stuff. I got skills, yo.
There's a skill. Oh, good lord. I've got skills. Is that with a Z? Oh, no, sorry, a Z. No, I have to start thinking in that way now. So, yeah, they produce every couple of years a list of the top 10 threats and vulnerabilities for web applications. And so they're looking at basically what all the hacks have been. And there's your top 10 list. And it's actually just recently changed. So I based my book partially on the 2007 list because, it's hard to actually think of things to write. So they've just updated it for 2010, and they've removed a couple of things and put a couple of things back in from previous versions. But it's a constantly evolving threat landscape, so they're pretty up to date. And it's not just online, all this stuff is online for free. They also have local chapters, so you can go along to OWASP meetings in your local area, if there is one, obviously. If you're in Timbuktu, I don't believe there's an OWASP Timbuktu, but there is one in Seattle. There's one in London. I'm sure there's probably one in LA and New York and all the rest of it. And you can just go along to these meetings for free and listen to people like me talk, which may or may not put you off. There's also MITRE, which produces a top 25 list. And then there's the Common Vulnerabilities and Exploits Database, CVE, which covers not just web applications, but everything from operating systems and thick clients and all the rest of it. And people just compile this stuff. And every now and again, someone will analyze it and go, oh, hey, look, this is new, or hey, look, this is old, but still we're not getting much done about it. And it's interesting to know, as the built-in protections for things evolve, the threats that are being used and the vulnerabilities that are being used, of course, change.
So we're talking about built-in protections, and I know that there are some tools specifically for ASP.NET, some of which you're probably working on now, which, yes. So do you want to talk about that? Like how
nice segue.
Yes. Well,
so, I mean, I should say up front, the build, you know, web protection tools only take you so far. So they're part of a defense in depth strategy. So you should always layer your defenses. You should be encoding any user input before you spit it out again. You should be using named parameters when you're talking to SQL. And there are things that can try and help you if you've forgotten or if someone else has written code and you don't have the source that you need to protect. But in the .NET framework and in the ASP, good old web forms and in the MVC stuff, a lot of these things are there. It just needs you to turn them on or to use them to their best effect. But if you can't do that, we have the Web Protection Library. This is an evolution of the Anti-XSS library, which is pretty well known now. It provides better encoding and decoding functionality based on a whitelist approach, as opposed to the way the standard .NET framework does it, which is blacklisting. So a whitelist of allowed things is always safer than a blacklist of things that you ban, because if new things come along, the blacklist isn't going to catch them. Whereas if new things come along, the whitelist isn't going to let them through, if you see what I mean. So the Web Protection Library is a bunch of HTTP modules that sit there and plug into the ASP.NET pipeline. And if you're using web forms, it will go through and it will try to encode all the control properties that need encoding. Because that's always been a little bit of a mess. It's kind of hard to work out sometimes whether controls encode things correctly for you. In fact, there's an enormous Excel spreadsheet that has a list of all the properties in each control that does need encoding or doesn't need encoding. It's not being a particularly clear story. So we have that, and then there's a module coming along that has an attempt to detect SQL injection, which is right now just detecting SQL injection for MS SQL. Although at the MVP summit last week, we had some volunteers that would write it for MySQL as well. And we're planning all sorts of other things for it. So it sort of sits there and it intercepts all the calls and it intercepts the input and it intercepts the output and tries to make stuff, you know, tries to do the right thing by you, just in case you haven't done it yourself. But these things come at a performance cost, obviously, because it has to parse each request and it has to parse each response. And there are all sorts of hokey stuff going on, but I've got plans for it that we'll probably be talking about publicly within the next few weeks.
So one of the other tools that I've used is called cat.net?
Yes, cat.net. So that's static code analysis. Yes, and that's the team that I have joined are responsible for that as well. In fact, we had a bug triage meeting for it yesterday, and we had the bug triage meeting for the Windows Protection Library today. And then there's the bug triage meeting for something that none of you know about yet tomorrow, which is just me being teasing. So what cat.net does, fxcop is there out of the box, so I'm sure we all turn the fxcop rules on, right?
No, because they're annoying.
John turns them on, don't you, John?
I turn them on and then forward the messages over to Scott Kuhn. I have like an email forwarder thing set up, so, yep.
Oh, I hate you all. Okay, so, let's start at the very beginning then. FXCOP is there to enforce some guidelines that the .NET framework uses itself. And it's not just things like, please don't use Hungarian notation, because every time you do, an angel loses its wings. It's stuff like performance hits. It's stuff like you've exposed something as a public property when really, no, that's a bad thing and you should be doing it as private. It has a bunch of inheritance rules. And it's basically there to clean up your code. If you want to go one step further, then you start looking at commercial tools like end-depend and stuff like that. But FXCOP is built into some of the SKUs. I'm not entirely sure which. Is it in Express? Does anyone know? I would doubt it.
No, it's not in Express. I didn't think it was built into any of them. I thought it was something.
But it is. Well, okay, originally it was a standalone tool. And then if you have a version of Visual Studio where you can right-click on the projects and underneath the properties you see something called code analysis, then you've got it. So FX Cop started being baked in I think it was VS 2008. I believe. Don't quote me on that. You know, I'm not in DevDiv, so I don't really know these things. But it's been baked in for a while, and it's certainly baked into VS 2010 as well. So the code analysis tab that you see on settings for a project is FX Cop underneath the hood. So it sits there and it looks through your assemblies and it looks at how the code's being compiled and it spits out a bunch of recommendations. And there are some security rules in there as well. And in fact, those security rules are part of the SDL process. The SDL process mandates that certain FX Cop rules must be turned on and there should be no errors before you release. So CAD.NET takes it a little bit further. It has a bunch of rules around configuration using the FX Cop engine. And then it does stuff analyzing data flow. So it looks at what it considers as input into your program, and it looks at where you're spitting it out. And then it goes, hold on, you've not encoded that properly, because it's untrusted input. So instead of FX Cop, which doesn't really understand control flow, it's just looking at what the code is, CAD.NET goes a lot further. And the original research, the original stuff came for that out of Microsoft Research. So it's, you know, it's big, scary, throbbing brain people coming up with working out how to actually trace the flow, backwards and forwards throughout a compiled program without actually running it. So it's another set of rules. It's another set of in-depth rules, and they're pretty much all security related. And it's something that you all ought to be running. I'm not entirely sure when it will come out for Visual Studio 2010. We're talking about pushing it out in the Power Tools release, which means it will be limited to certain editions. I'm not entirely sure which, so I can't tell you what versions of Visual Studio will enable it, but you should see it around the first, you should see it along with the first drop of Power Tools for Visual Studio 2010. The stuff that's out there right now works well with Visual Studio 2008. And it's just an extra little plug-in and an extra little menu item on the toolbar and in the menus. But with the next version of CAD.NET, it will just appear as part and parcel of the compiler. And it's more rules for you to turn on, or in John's case, turn off and ignore.
I didn't say that. I said I forwarded them to Scott Kuhn.
So in defense of sanity, FX Cop does include a lot of security rules, but it also includes a lot of rules that only make sense if you're working at Microsoft.
Don't think that's entirely true. StyleCop certainly includes a lot of rules that only make sense if you're working in Microsoft, and probably not even then.
the stuff surrounding parameters and the kinds of things you should and shouldn't pass through as parameters, primarily
don't pass in collections that you can iterate and change, because that's just silly. Return read-only collections and stuff like that. So stuff around mutability of parameters and return types and things. That's not just being at Microsoft. That's just SAN coding practices that we learned once and forgot.
If you look through the ASP.NET MVC code, you see tons of suppress message.
You'd have to talk to Mr. Hack about that. I actually haven't looked through the ASP.NET MVC code, to be perfectly honest. But yes, I mean, sometimes there are always going to be false positives from these tools. And CAD.NET is prone to them as well, because it's doing an awful lot more. And you can't be 100% accurate, which is a horrible statement to make, but it's true of all security tools. You're either going to get false positives or something's going to be missed. So they are not a silver bullet. And if you get a false positive, well, you can justify an exception and you can turn the rule off for that one area of code.
So which would you say is not necessarily more important, but you want to put more emphasis on this rather than that, and let's replace this with proactively trying to cut off known routes of known attack vectors versus
potential ones.
Putting some thought towards mitigation. So if they get in, how can you contain where they can go and what they can do?
So At the end of the day, there's really one simple rule. You don't trust anyone. Any input that comes into your system, be it from a user, be it from a database, be it from a web service, you treat as tainted. So the way I used to say it is you just, you know, you put your security hat on and what you believe is all your users are scum because you can't trust a damn thing that they say because whatever they say may be an attack.
I thought that was interesting, by the way. You mentioned their database, and I saw recently, I think over Twitter, you mentioned something that was a tool that would put a bunch of security vulnerabilities into your database to test that you were encrypted.
Yes! I can't remember what that was now. Someone had written something that just chunked through a database and started putting cross-site scripting vulnerabilities into any text field that it found.
Yeah.
Because that
we've done that a couple of times on projects. We've also included SQL injection stuff that you know gets put in, and then if the user or one of our testers visits the page, it'll inject something into a table that says, you know, whoops.
Well, yeah, I mean, but that's an interesting one because people do tend to ask, well, should I encode data before I store it in the database, or should I encode it once I pulled it back at the point of delivery? And my opinion, and the opinion of people that have larger brains than me, is that you encode at the point of delivery because you're doing that for a couple of reasons. One, you may want the data in different formats, so an encoding for HTML is perhaps not a suitable encoding for sending data as XML. And suddenly you're like, oh dear, what do I do now? And the other point is, well, if heaven forfend there's a bug in the encoding methods or the encoding software that you're using, if you encode before you store, you may have encoded something that's vulnerable. Whereas if you encode at the point of delivery, well, all you do is you slot in the latest and greatest and hopefully bug-free version of the encoder, and everything after that point is always going to be correct, including data that was stored before. If you see what I mean. Does that make a vague amount of sense?
Yes.
Everyone's
going for it. By the way, I found that thing, so we'll put it in the show notes. It's on acorns.com.au/blog and then P154, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure it'll make more sense as an actual hyperlink.
Yes, that's not very good SEO. Which blog engine are they running?
Yeah.
So yes, so you know what, if you treat all user input with the disdain that it deserves, then you're going to sanitize it. You're going to realize that, well, you can't trust users, so you need to use parameterized SQL, although that's not always enough. You need to HTML encode or HTML attribute encode or XML encode or JSON encode and all the rest of it. And by doing so, well, then you're mitigating, you know, a couple of the greatest risks. The greatest risk right out there right now seems to be cross-site scripting, closely followed by SQL injection, which is really worrying because that's been around for years. And then we're getting on to slightly more hokey things like cross-site request forgery and bits and pieces like that. But the two main ones, cross-site scripting and SQL injection, there's no excuse for not doing the right thing.
Now, with cross-site scripting, a lot of that is... Well, there's a temptation in ASP.NET land to think that some of that is protected for you by the frameworks. Like, for instance, definitely WebForms had some, and then there are some checks in MVC, too, that you can do that will protect you against cross-site scripting. Is that naive to just think that the framework is helpful?
You mean request validation?
Yes.
So you have a blog comment page. And I'm sure at some point someone will want to make a smiley face or something that involves a less than and a greater than sign. So you have to turn request validation off. On that page, I should underscore this, please never ever turn request validation off on an application-wide basis. Do it on a page-by-page basis, please. So you turn it off so people can put in less than or greater than or ampersands or whatever. And now that page is vulnerable unless you're encoding everything that you output. So again, request validation, and I believe MSDN says it, request validation, you know, it's not 100% reliable. There are ways around it. There are known ways around it. There are ways that you can fool it. It's just part of a defense in depth strategy. So there's an XSS cheat sheet URL that I will make sure that you have before the end of the evening. I think it's somewhere on hackers.something or other.
Yes.
But it's, yes, you know the one I mean.
Yep.
So it's huge. And it's got it's got well over 75, I think they're up to 100 now, different ways of trying to bypass filters. And you know, the best will in the world, request validation only gets updated with the .NET, with the framework cycle. So, you know, when things are notified, well, we have to go through all the regression testing and all the rest of it to make sure it doesn't break other things. So whilst that happens, just in case something does slip by, well, you should be encoding it anyway. It doesn't do any harm. And it's just this whole, we've got to layer defenses upon defenses.
Well, and lots of, I mean, so lots of people will always encode and check, you know, the obvious stuff, like stuff coming from HTML inputs or things like that. But we got dinged on one app because we were pulling something from the header.
Oh, yes. Headers are fun.
Or cookies.
So
they'll put SQL injection code or cross-site scripting stuff in a cookie.
Yes.
And then they'll send it in. And, you know, we just parse that and store it with the profile data, or, you know, we just pass it along to a SQL or a Sprock.
Yeah, the favorite one for that is accept language, because people tend to pull out whatever the favorite language is and then start pulling resources out of a database based upon that. So select label name from localized resources where language equals en-gb. So you change en-gb to be a SQL injection string, and bang, because people assume that anything that's coming down as a header is always going to be correct because it's generated by the browser.
People think to check form fields, but people don't think that you're going to be monkeying with headers.
No, indeed. I mean, there's a split header attack, but actually the .NET framework does a really good job of protecting against that. But there's an extension for Firefox called Tamper Data, and that's just utterly lovely. So what happens is you turn it on, you submit a form, and before the form submits, it presents you with, well, all the form fields. But it also presents you with all the headers and cookies, and you can edit the request and then just click go, and it passes it on, and you can watch, you know, all sorts of fun things happen with that. And, you know, that one's quite fun even for the MVC bits and pieces. So this is where John will perk up now. But model so binding to models. So you have the default binding bits and pieces that will go through all the fields and attempt to put the values from fields from a form against an instance of the model, right?
Yep.
Am I explaining this in proper MVC terms?
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay. But so by default, that just works on field names. So I've sat there and I've used tamper data, and what I've done is I've inserted an ID field or something that I guess can be in the model behind the scenes, and it'll get updated. Unless you've changed your model binding, so it's on a whitelisted approach, so you can set a bind include parameter where you can actually list exactly what should be bindable for that model.
Now,
make sense?
Yes, but have you checked that?
Am I explaining this badly?
No. I think that
you're MVC boy.
Yes, I think that makes sense. I want to check if that's something you've looked at for MVC 2 as well, because with the MVC 2 attribute based validation, you're actually putting your validation rules. You're putting your metadata on your model, and so it's supposed to do a better job at checking against under and over posting.
Well, validation rules are a whole other thing. So I thought that was silly. I mean, I haven't looked at MVC 2, and that's funny.
Busted.
I'm having lunch with Mr. Hack next week, so he's probably going to beat me up now. Hey, look, I had enough to do writing a book for MVC 1, and the last 3 weeks I haven't had a chance to sit down and breathe yet. There's just this fire hose of Microsoft data from as soon as you walk in the door that you're trying to swim against. It's plus, you know, that the area where they put that implant, that still hurts.
Yes.
How long did it take for your bruises to get down?
They're still going on. You know what's funny is I had naively thought that the fire hose was not such a big deal, and that was because I had started in December when everyone was on vacation, and when they showed up in January, I was just deluged. It was awesome. It still is awesome.
So back to the cookies and the header thing.
Yes.
The scariest code I've ever seen was a single line of C# ASP in an ASPX page. And Barry has probably seen this hundreds of times. Anyway, what this code did was it did an assembly dot read from, or an appdomain dot read from, and it did a binary read on the contents of the cookie.
No! On earth would you want to do something like that?
Because then you could binary serialize out an assembly, a .NET assembly, put it into your cookie, and then you could essentially load any assembly you wanted to in the current running app domain on the web server that you've compromised.
Well, yeah. Wow. That's it. But.
That's... Yeah. That was the scariest code I've ever seen.
But of course, this then proves that, you know, if you allow people to upload files, you should put them outside your web root and all the rest of it. I do have a chapter on file handling in the book.
Yeah, and for God's sake, set the execute bit to off.
Well, yeah, you stick it outside the web root, and you don't actually directly refer to it anyway. So if you upload files and you ever want to serve them up, you don't let ASP.NET do it. You have a stub file somewhere that basically reads it and spits it out. So you're not letting ASP.NET process it as it would an ASPX page.
Oh, see, I warned you about this. Now Kevin's going to ask a question.
Oh, that's not good, because he's been quite quiet. You guys told me he was scary and weird.
He waits for a long time, saving up, and then at the right time he strikes.
Oh, Lord.
All right, do I get to ask my question now?
Yes.
All right. So we touched a little bit about what the framework does do for you or doesn't do for you. Mm-hmm. As far as protecting you in these cases. And I'm curious as to whether you feel like the frameworks just don't do enough. I mean, there's limitations to what a framework, you know, any framework can do, and there's new kinds of vulnerabilities. But, you know, a lot of web frameworks have taken heat, you know, MVC included, for not automatically encoding output for you and not doing sort of pit of success kinds of...
Well, the not encoding output is an interesting one. And I must admit, I was a little bit perturbed by it. I would like to have, I'd like to have seen the MVC stuff encode by default. And then I sat down and tried to work out how you do it. And by doing that, in order to do it, you would have to understand the exact layout of the page that you're outputting to. Where you are in the page, whether you're in a header, where the rules are different for encoding, whether you're in an HTML attribute where the rules are different, whether you're spitting out a URL where the rules are different. And automatically encoding is an awfully difficult problem to fix. And I'm not sure it's doable right now at all until we perhaps move across and everyone writes valid XHTML, which is slightly easier parsable than the very loose mess of HTML we have right now, where you may have missing tags or unbalanced tags or all the rest of it. I don't think that one's an easy one to solve. And I'm not entirely sure it should be down to a framework. A framework should give you the tools. There was a great book when I was young, in the late 1980s, which is one of the ones that I used to learn C. I think it was a C and a C++ test book that was entitled Enough Rope to Shoot Yourself in the Foot. That's what frameworks should be providing. They should be providing you the facility to be safe, but perhaps not forcing it on you, because people can't make that decision for you. That's like saying, at some point your mother let you cross the road by yourself. Well, John's mother, perhaps not.
Yeah, I call her up. And then
you get permission.
It's easier now with the cell phone because I can actually video. I can show her that it's safe. But go on.
And she's tracking you on Google Maps.
The GPS. Oh,
Bing,
yeah.
Sorry, Bing Maps.
We had to switch over.
Yeah, I know.
That implant's not taken, is it?
I'm being shocked now. Damn it. It's reporting. So, So where was I? Oh, yeah. At some point, you have to grow up and take responsibility for yourself. And frameworks cannot do everything for you. And I'm of the opinion that they shouldn't. Some people disagree, and that's absolutely fine. They're wrong, but they can disagree.
What do you think of the MVC HTML string encoding, the percent colon or less than percent colon approach?
That's coming in. Is that coming in ASP.NET 4 as well?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Well, you see, that's fine.
Technically, but... an MVC 2, but yes.
Yes. And in fact, that has a provider model behind it, so you can swap out the server.html encode that it uses and put in the anti-XSS one. I know, I'm writing that code next week. It's in my list of things to do that's fun. So I like that, but it's not doing it automatically for you. If you think about it, you're making a conscious decision to use the percent colon. And that's what I want to see. I like that because it makes people think more about what they're doing. But then you have the problems of developers that don't know about it or miss it or forget. It's part of the whole, it's part of a whole professionalism thing, and I don't think that's something a framework or any tool set can solve.
So there are definitely things that if you know that you should be testing for, there are things that you should be doing in your application. There are tools you can run to check for vulnerabilities. I mean, are there things where, like, I'm Joe Developer, I just wrote a website, I would like to check my site for XSS or CSRF or, you know, some basic things. Is there automated testing that's worth a damn?
That's a difficult one to say. I've used some automated testing tools. Some of them have left a lot to be desired in terms of either they don't find anything or they fire out far too many false positives. I think that's one of those things that you need to experiment for yourself and find one that you're comfortable with. Just because different people want different things from these tools. And there are some free ones out there. And again, the OWASP site or your local OWASP chapter, you'll be able to go along and talk to people who have had this pain before you. So they may be able to recommend something that works for you or would work for your environment or your setup. It's just too big and too generic a question. And, you know, the ones that I've used, I've not had happy experiences with. So I'm not going to name and shame because that would be wrong.
So while I'm asking that, in terms of, are there just, you know, a top two or three list of things to do both in an MVC app and a web forms app of things, you know, do not pass go, you must check these things in your application.
Do not pass input as output. There you go.
Okay.
Do not pass input as output. So we have the cross-site scripting bits and pieces. Protect your forms against cross-site request forgery. Guard against SQL injection by using parameterized queries. And for goodness sake, if you have to have dynamic SQL within stored procedures, pass parameterized queries to that again, because you can use parameterized queries within SQL queries themselves, which is one that always gets people. So you'll see people go, oh, well, I've passed things in as parameters, and that's absolutely fine. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a select statement, because that's the only way I can do filtering for a search. No, you then have to build the select statement up and actually pass the parameters that you've passed in as parameters to that select statement, which is fun. Mm-hmm. And let me see, what about other ones? Protect your cookies, so HTTP-only cookies if you're using ones of your own. So what that will do is cookies that are marked as HTTP-only will not be accessible via scripting on the client side. So if you do get a cross-site scripting attack, they can't get at your cookies. So the ASP.NET framework will protect session cookies and the forms auth cookie. They're all HTTP-only, but that's actually quite dependent on browser support. So last time I looked, which was about 6 months ago, Safari still didn't support it. But then Apple's attitude to security does leave a lot to be desired.
Wow. Okay, and that's something, actually, I remember Jeff Atwood wrote about this back in 2008, about something that they ran into, the HTTP-only cookies.
Yeah, they're great when the browser supports them. And I guess that's probably, I mean, obviously, you know, you go out and you buy my book, you plow your way through it, and I get all of just probably about 20p, 20 pence. I don't know what that is in cents, because frankly, I'm still confused by your coins. And people, someone asked me today for, oh, I need another nickel. And I'm looking at her like, what? What? Here, look at all these coins in my hand. Take the one that you want.
Yeah, we generally, that the main currency here again is in shotgun shells. So 20p would work out to about 4 shotgun shells.
Yeah, and the nickel, and the nickel is the green paper with the guy with the beard on the front.
Right. So we'll set you straight. If you have any questions,
yeah. Yep. Yeah, you asked me to borrow one of those, didn't you?
You can tell because it has a 5 in the corner.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yeah, don't get me started on your notes and the fact that they're all the same size and they're all the same color and you can't tell them apart, unlike any other sensible country. But yeah, anyway.
Well, you do have to know your numbers. You need those.
Yeah, that's complicated because, you know, you don't put U's in your numbers. This is silence now. So,
what?
So basically, I mean, what I did try to do with the book, and I'll pimp this a little bit more because I can, is that it's split up into topic areas. So rather than just trying to look at it as a theoretical approach, what I tried to do was each chapter is reasonably self-contained. So chapter 3 deals with accepting user input and what you can do with it. You skip across to chapter 6 and it's talking about how to keep things secret, so that's hashing and encryption. So it's kind of task based, so you know, if you know that you're about to do something and you want to make sure that you're covered, you can just read that chapter. You don't have to read the entire book, that would be lovely. but you don't have to. You can dip in and out as it goes. A bit like the ASP.NET tips book that you all threw out quite a while ago. That was dippable, eminently dippable. So you don't have to worry about knowing everything. You know, if you're not going to be using XML, then don't read the securing XML chapter. If you're not going to be using WCF, don't read the WCF chapter. And it's there for you when you eventually do start to use these things.
What do you think, by the way, too, of RIA security, for instance, you know, like Silverlight security, especially, because there's a lot going over the wire, there's cross-domain stuff, there's all that.
Do you really call it RIA?
What do you call it?
Don't pronounce that? I do the RIA thing.
RIA.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. That's fine. Okay, well, yeah. So the rich internet application stuff, because I'm not saying RIA, that's just silly. It doesn't open up anything new. It just gives somewhere else to run the same old attacks against.
Well, yeah, so, except you're running, you know, potentially, then you have on the client, you've got .NET code. I mean, it's more locked down.
It's sandboxed. It's sandboxed.NET code, and it's in theory that sandbox is unbreakable. In practice, we know that software doesn't work like that. Although, if anything, you know, for breaking sandboxes and writing dodgy stuff that's plugged into clients, I think Adobe takes the lead right now. Someone came up with a statistic this week that apparently something like over 60% of drive-by downloads are now infected PDFs. That's just stunning. That's wow.
What, there are many vulnerabilities in Foxit?
Uh-huh. Oh, you evil man. And the last Flash security update and the last Shockwave update required you to manually uninstall Flash and Shockwave before you can install the latest protected versions. How many of you have done that recently? Because there was a Flash update a week and a half ago. How many of you have actually gone back to check that your Flash version number is in fact patched and up to date? Silence.
What about not installing Flash?
Well, yeah, that's another option. I have NoScript running in Firefox, and I don't have Flash installed in IE at all, which is great because you want to browse something without getting lots of ads. Yeah, IE is where I'm going right now. So the rich internet applications don't open up new vulnerabilities, but they do open up new vectors. I have a chapter on that too.
What got me thinking of that was I saw a security article where they were talking about you could basically set a breakpoint, like you can break into a Silverlight application running in your browser, right? Because it's managed code. And yes. So from the point of view of somebody that's writing an application, they may think, oh, this is Silverlight, you know, whatever, and not...
Oh, and then I trust everything that's coming from it.
Exactly. And so in this case,
This goes back to don't trust any user input and treat everything as tainted and treat all your users as scum. Just because it's coming from Silverlight doesn't mean it's correct. It's like HTTP headers or like cookies or like a straightforward form request. Everything can be edited. Everything can be fixed. So don't trust your input and on the server. Validate, validate, validate.
Is this the part of the show where we wake up K. Scott?
We haven't heard the birds, so
he's in Reno. You're in Reno this week, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I'm on the West Coast. We're in the Pacific time zone.
Ah.
Oh, I know about Reno because I've seen that documentary, Reno 911.
That's right. That's crazy here.
Yeah.
That's actually a documentary about Portland, though. It's just they couldn't use Portland. They just used Reno.
That explains Hanselman, frankly.
So we've been talking primarily looking at it from the web point of view. The scary stuff is all because we're all exposed and we're socially accessing APIs and Twittering and Facebooking and
oh yeah, I mean the whole social networking thing is a whole other problem, but that's down to people's behavior.
Yeah, we haven't talked anything about social engineering because people are just going to either get it or not, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you either trust to you know, give out your address and social security number to any email that comes through, or you don't.
I don't have a social security number yet. It's great. So I went to get my new phone, and I had to, you know, they're like, can we have your social security number? No, I'm sorry, we don't I don't have one. Okay, well, what we'll do is we'll fake it, and then when anything asks you for the last four digits of your social security number in our system, just type 111. And they're like, and then you need to tell us when you get your social security number. And I'm thinking, You're AT&T. No, I really don't.
Nope.
You're not getting it. When I get bank's getting it. But it's scary how, you know, American industry demands your social security number for the most innocuous, bizarre things.
What's even funnier is when they give it to you, they say it's not to be used as identification.
Yeah, and everyone does.
It's ridiculous in that it's publicly available and it's commonly used as a security token. So, you know, anyone that's bought or sold a house, you can go look up their social security number. But a lot of other things too. I mean, anyone, if you do any security check on someone, it's not difficult to find someone's social security number, I've been told. But it's also commonly used as a security token, especially the last four. It's poor.
It's hilarious. Yeah. Along with your date of birth, easily discoverable, especially on Facebook. Your mother's maiden name, that's usually another good one. And it's like, it's great fun. Hey, when your bank rings you up, do you ask them to verify who they are? You don't, do you?
Nope.
I don't. It's hilarious. I don't give away anything when the bank calls me up because I have nothing. There's nothing that my bank is going to tell me that requires me to give them any information.
Plus, you don't actually have any money in your account.
Mm. No.
They're ringing you up to say, please, can you give us $5? Because, you know, you haven't given us enough out of your taxes. We just need $5 and you don't have anything in here and we're feeling lonely. Please come talk to us.
So we've been primarily talking about the web side of things, but what about client security? So should we worry about running that click once installer? Should we, you know, that doesn't actually do anything on the internet, doesn't connect to any services, never leaves your machine?
That's an interesting one. Click once. Let's take click once out of the equation.
Because that's a horrible example. But
actually sandbox. Yeah, so any application that you install on your machine, you're trusting to do the right thing. So you need to look at things that are coming from a trusted source. And everyone says, you know the usual things, when the Windows 7 betas, it's not betas, people, it's our language, pronounce it the way we say it.
Betas?
The Windows 7 betas made it up onto the peer-to-peer networks. And so the usual email goes out going, you know what, if you download this, it could well be infected. And everyone goes, oh, that's just Microsoft trying to stop us copying things. Well, it's not. It could be. Every time you install something, you take your machine in your hands and you trust that the code that you're installing is good. And there's not really a lot of ways to prove that. So .NET had CAS and the sandbox model, which has been simplified and has switched around to various other models underneath .NET 4. Java has its sandbox. I wish that we could have an OS sandbox. Something that's buried deep in the OS, and when you run something for the first time, it says, these are the permissions that I would like to grant it, and nothing else. But we don't.
Similar to, like, a lot of phone apps do that. Like, when you run the app or install the app, it'll say, this app wants access to...
To get your GPS location.
Yeah.
I don't know. What phone are you running that on, John?
This is a Windows mobile Droid phone.
Okay, fair enough.
I've actually been championing, or not championing, because that makes it sound like I'm actually doing things about it, but yeah, I've been saying for a while that it'd be nice to have per-app VMs so that, you know, the app gets bundled with just enough OS to boot up and run, and, you know, it doesn't need access to your actual system.
There is a facility that's up and coming for called AppV that allows the virtualization of applications. I don't know how it works. I don't know its availability. I don't know how much it costs. I just know it's there. And I'm sure other people like VMware and other virtualization folks have got their own solutions. I just don't know that's best well enough to comment.
There's a technology that Microsoft bought from SoftGrid a while ago. There's a group of technologies, and one of them is there are two things SoftGrid provides. One is the ability to stream applications. So, and they're using that, I believe, in Microsoft Office 2010.
Oh, that's why you get the mysterious Q drive.
Maybe. There's the whole click to run thing where you run it and it streams the app down to you, and you can start using apps immediately or soon, and it keeps streaming features down to you. And that is, I think, an interesting feature. But the other thing that SoftGrid provided was this whole sandbox thing where they had this system guard environment, and it was a whole sandbox thing where it would virtualize your registry and all that. I actually wrote a post on this back in 2007 when I was arguing with Jeff Atwood about virtualizing.
Is that when you still had hair?
No, actually, I lost all my hair back quite a while ago.
Okay, just checking.
Yes, yes. I did have an outrageous wig at that time, but...
Okay, hold on. Are there pictures available?
Oh, no, actually, I've dreamed of having just a great wig that would be, like, right on the edge of, damn, you're wearing a wig. What's wrong with you? And, like, not wanting to say something. You know what I mean? Like, just right on the edge where people would, like, look at you weird but not actually have the courage to say something. So if you do see something like that, let me know. But
okay.
But
it'll be Rambo colored.
Yes. Well, no. That's too obvious. I do want
something. Oh, so you want something that looks like a really, really bad toupee.
I want something that looks like I'm trying, but just didn't quite pull it off.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, this is something that I looked at because I was arguing with Jeff about the problem with virtualizing to me is that it's like you want to keep someone safe in their house, so you build a wall around the entire city. In other words, to virtualize an operating system, you've got a separate copy of everything. You've got a network stack. You've got a separate copy of Notepad. You've got a separate copy of MS Paint. You've got everything. You're virtualizing the entire world just to sandbox one application in a lot of cases.
Yeah, no, that's true. Because, I mean, you have XP mode now in Windows 7, and I use that to run IE6 in.
Right, but technically, I mean, so from a UI perspective, you're hiding everything. But really, you're running an entire XP instance when you do that, right?
Yes, indeed.
So
I actually don't know how it works if I run multiple applications from XP mode. But I would doubt that it spins up too, because that would be insane on consumer machines.
Right. So, so that's kind of, lipstick on a pig, to use the colloquialism. It's, I don't know what the English colloquialism would be for that.
No, lipstick on a pig is absolutely good. Fine.
So, that's something where, and code access security was broken in terms of the developer story, but it's a better story, I think, in terms of application development, where you're sandboxing an application rather than the entire operating system.
That's true, but one of the problems with code access security was it was only applicable to managed code.
Right.
So, you can still write an unmanaged executable that would run riot. If the world had switched to managed code, then code access security would be an incredibly fun idea. And you can still sandbox in .NET 4. It's just a lot simpler. And other people know this inside and out, and when I try and explain it, I start getting confused again myself, so I'll stop that sort of conversation, because these people can track me down now. They can look me up, and they know where my desk is. That's scary. It's all right for John. He's not actually...
Right.
He's not up here. He's remote.
I can hear them coming.
In more ways than one.
Let's see. Yada, yada, yada. We're at a...
I love
right,
the
a
yada,
little
yada,
over
yada,
an hour.
Yeah.
I love the fact that you got no smart arse questions on Twitter. I told you, the whole entire UK community is asleep. If you'd have asked 6 hours ago, you'd have got lots.
Javier Lonzano, old Jimmy Lonzano, wants to know what you know about FoxPro.
So the very first MVP summit I went to, for the product group dinners, because the product groups take their MVPs out. We were in the same Microsoft cafe as the Visual Fox, but the developer security guys were in the same cafe as the Visual Fox Pro people. There's a lot of them. They're very, very passionate. and therefore I'm saying nothing more than it's got some very passionate followers and admirers. I should point out that at that MVP summit, we were actually bundled in with the J-Sharp MVP. He's developer security and J-Sharp.
That's a good sign.
and he didn't actually turn up. He didn't turn up to this at all. I don't know if he still exists. I think there are still FoxPro MVPs. I'm not entirely sure. It's quite strange. But, people get passionate about things. You witness the whole, we're not throwing our way our view state and our web controls, and the MVC is the spawn of Satan, arguments that are going on still. when really no one's taking your web controls away. You keep doing what you're doing. We're still going to be supported. People just like a technology, and if it works for them, why the heck not?
Let's see. Do we have anything else? We've got your pimp in the book already.
Yeah, we got me pimping the book quite a few times.
So tell them about the iPhone and the base station. I don't know. What do you call it? A compromise or a scary bit?
It's a bit of silliness. So every year, Microsoft has a security conference called Blue Hat, where they invite people from outside Microsoft to present. So I've been to the last couple. I used my MVP credentials to get in. And then actually I did the interview loop afterwards the next week, which was quite interesting. But so iPhones connect in Starbucks to the free Wi-Fi automatically. I believe that's the case. They certainly connect to certain preferred partners automatically.
So mine was set up automatically with the ATT.
Yes.
SSID. And so it's automatically set to join that one. So I noticed if I'm driving by a store, it'll pop up.
And of course, those are unsecured, right?
Right.
Okay. So what happens if you sit in an airport and have a laptop that's, because you can get certain laptop wireless cards that you can reconfigure to be APs, right? Access points. Mm-hmm. So if you set it as a SID, of AT&T, and people walk through the airport with wireless turned on, although why you really want to leave wireless turned on when the battery life on an iPhone sucks so much already, but people do. So someone's performed this experiment where he just sits there with a laptop that's broadcasting itself as an AT&T access point, and iPhones walk past, they automatically connect, and then they try and download email, because it's like, oh, hey, look, I've got a wireless connection, so I'm going to suck email down. Isn't that fun, boys and girls? Because the email protocols generally are still not encrypted. So you do a POP3 or an IMAP, unless you're doing secure IMAP or SPOP3, your username and password goes in certain circumstances. And the same for outgoing emails. ActiveSync is different. It's SSL protected. But isn't that fun?
Yes.
Indeed. So next time you're walking through an airport, turn your phone off.
There was another one that I was thinking of. Maybe this is the one you were thinking that's not public, where they actually could load compromised certificates onto the phone.
Doesn't ring a bell, to be perfectly honest. The great fun thing that they had was someone turned up with what was basically a cell phone repeater in a box that they built out of some common components. And all it does is fake report. That's what it was. It was fake reporting that it was a valid cell phone. And so what would happen is the way cell phones negotiate the encryption keys, you just tell it, I only support the lowest one. And then what you're doing is you're forwarding that onto the nearest tower so the actual conversation flows. But because it's encrypted to you with a really, really low key, it's crackable in about a minute and a half. So you just get a minute to a minute and a half's lag, but you've got conversation that you can sniff.
Wow.
And they eventually changed their mind about demoing that, but I believe they talked about it at Black Hat afterwards.
So what we're talking about, that reminds me to ask, are there security things that people do that are just completely snake oil, like are worthless in terms of security?
Ooh, that's a difficult one because, you know, I'm going to end up insulting someone's product.
Please do.
No. You know what? I've been employed by Microsoft for 2.5 weeks so far. The last thing... No, come on.
No, wait. No, I'm not talking about products. I'm just saying secure, you know, like cargo cult sort of things that people always do that really they think are maybe provided. Like, for instance, there's the whole, you know, write your own cipher kind of thing, which is ridiculous.
Because I'm really cleverer than a bunch of mathematicians.
Yes.
I'll tell you, the one that always makes me laugh is people that have software firewalls that warn them of every incoming request on the internet. Or that someone's pinged them. And that just makes me laugh. Because you know what? That's just background noise. And if you don't have the alerts on, you're still protected. So all you're doing is getting like little pop-up bubbles. And that makes you feel safer because you see something's happening. Or you get a button. And then, you know, these people try and track down IPs and send emails off to the ISPs. Only IPs going, oh, there's some evil hacker in your network that's sending me a ping. And I've seen emails like that. And they're really funny.
Okay. Oh, I do have one more question. I kept reminding myself.
Oh.
Yes. OpenID. So we've gone back and forth on Twitter. about OpenID. I like the concept, although I understand there are security concerns.
There are.
I do like, from a security perspective, I don't like giving my username and password out to every single website that I use. I prefer the idea of...
Well, from a security perspective, every single website that you use, of course, has a unique username and password combination, doesn't it, John?
Sure. Yeah. I don't think anyone actually does that. I mean, or they use a browser plugin.
Yeah, we use browser plugins. I use LastPass to
right,
do it.
Right, which is good, but also has problems. So I think that the idea of, instead of presenting a username and password to a site, using some system that I trust to present mm-hmm. a token, a third-party yes. authentication system. So I think we both would probably prefer something like CardSpace or InfoCard. If it was popular and running and all that, I would prefer to use InfoCard, and then at the operating system level, I would hop,
you get a consistent UI and all the rest of it, things that the OpenID and a web interface cannot provide.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you're going to Kim Cameron's laws of identity, really.
Yeah. But the problem is, circa today, we don't have CardSpace running many places. We don't have it accepted many places. We don't have CardSpace providers.
That's true, yes.
So I at least like the idea of OpenID in terms of, I don't like giving my, giving a username, password, any other identity information to a bunch of websites. I'd prefer to...
Because, I wouldn't trust Stack Overflow either.
Hell no. Those guys are a bunch of monkeys, right?
that Atwood guy doesn't even like white chocolate.
Right.
He's a freak.
And no coffee, and he doesn't like avocados, now I learn. So,
really?
Yes. So how can we trust him? Nope. Definitely a communist.
Yeah. To kick him out of California for that?
He is obviously a communist, yes. So I don't want to give my credentials to Stack Overflow.
Yes.
I then... prefer personally the OpenID approach, but you have told me I'm a bad man for that.
No, have I? Oh, good.
Yes,
I'm glad.
Yes, you have.
I will slightly modify that story. You know what? Yes, you're right. In an ideal world, we would be using an operating system based identity selector, because that way you get a consistent user interface, and they're harder to hack. And if you're interested in that, you go to Kim Cameron's blogs and you read his law of identity. Unfortunately, CardSpace has not been pushed. There is no wide adoption. So, you know what? OpenID is what we're stuck with right now until something better comes along.
So are we stuck with it in terms of it's a bad system, don't use it, or we're stuck with it in terms of it's good enough?
Stuck with it in terms of it's good enough, but it could be a lot better.
Okay.
And of course, on the other side of OpenID, you have OAuth, and OAuth is an interesting one because have you noticed that the Twitter clients now are stopping asking you for usernames and passwords, and instead sending you off to Twitter to get an authorization token back, and bringing it back to the application, and away it goes.
Yeah.
So Twitter are moving across to OAuth, and Facebook does the same thing. So when you use a Facebook app, it says, this application wants to access your timeline, yes or no. It wants permissions to post on your wall. It wants permissions to go through all your friends' information and take their telephone numbers, their inside leg measurements, and work out whether their girlfriends are hot, then steal their photos. So Facebook has very granular permissions for OAuth. Twitter has one. It has, this wants to access your account, period. That is a bad implementation. OAuth is like, apparently in this land of the free, you have this thing called valet keys. So if you're driving a Lexus or something, you can hand over a particular key to the valet, and it only lets them drive for a certain length of time and doesn't let them do a bunch of things in the car.
Like open the trunk.
Is it?
I think they can't find
They can't find the body.
Hopefully not. Although they could possibly lower the back seats.
Yeah, they could go in through the back seats. That's what I was immediately thinking. I'm thinking, all right, fine. But anyway.
So you've been through this problem too. Yeah, it is hard to dispose of
the back seats.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Indeed.
So go ahead.
So OAuth is another thing that's a great idea, but some people's implementation of it sucks. Twitter just doesn't get it. You know, they're like, oh, we're going to be more secure because we're moving to OAuth. Well, no, you're not, because you're just granting permission of people can do anything on your account or people can do nothing at all. That's not helpful.
Right.
It's real.
That's back to the pseudo model. We're saying, you can run, here's my credentials, run as me.
Yes, and that's it.
Okay. What do you think? I don't know if you've looked at this whole OAuth wrap thing.
I haven't actually, and that's funny because I got an email off one of my friends tonight saying, "Do you have an opinion in this yet?" So I haven't had a chance to look at it.
Okay.
Period. Yeah, it's nothing I can say.
Okay. I'm out of questions. I'd wanted to talk to you about that, and I thought this was, you know, interesting to get it on the podcast. But I was curious about your ideas on OpenID. I do think it's broken, but the best thing we've got going right now, as far as
like so many things.
Yeah.
If only I could persuade women to have that attitude about me.
Right.
So that's all for this week on Herding Code. Tune in next week when we'll have more exciting guests and questions.
Or does maybe that mean we'll I was an exciting guest?
I said more. Yes. You can put that on your resume now.
Cool.
Exciting guest on Herding Code.
Do you mean that we will have more exciting than Barry guests?
More exciting than me? Cause,
or
you know,
just
that,
we will continue to have exciting guests?
I want to know who's more exciting than me because I need to track them down and kill them. You know what? That's not good for my ego.
Probably Rob Connery.
I know Miguel has generally been more exciting than you.
Yeah, okay. No, Miguel's way more exciting than me.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And Rob, probably, yeah.
Fortunately, both of those people are thousands of miles away from you.
That's true. Yeah. Not Phil, though, because, you know, he's got the whole staid married life thing going on.
Right.
Whereas, you know, here I am in a new country, too scared to go outside because you all have guns.
Phil is an exciting person, but for the sake of not having him harmed by you, I'm going to say he's not.
Yes, Phil is a lovely person at that. So.
Yes, lovely person.
Maybe we should wind this up before I start going through various Microsoft staffers who are more important than me and insulting them. That would be a good thing.
You know that Brad Abrams guy you had on? I'm more exciting than him, right?
That's Scott Hanselman.
I don't know, Barry. He was actually launching a product.
Was it? Yeah, and he does have that really tidy beard.
He does?
Yeah, he's got this little tidy.
No, you're mixing up Scott Hanselman and Brad.
And Brad Abrams.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd already switched to Hanselman.
Yes. Yeah, now, Brad recently had tweeted that he was getting a unicycle, and I said, I will give you, you know, just complete homage if you actually can incorporate that into a presentation. Just come riding out on a unicycle for your talk. How do you beat that? You can't. There's no way.
There are a couple of people I've seen.
No.
I've seen commute to work in a unicycle in Seattle.
My friend had a unicycle stolen, and he was trying to picture, you know, like, what was the guy, you know, did somebody run up to his house and ride away on a unicycle, like some deranged clown? Like, ah!
Or you just stick it underneath your arm. Let's be practical.
That's
here.
Probably more like...
How bad do you need to really want to learn to ride a unicycle to steal one?
Right.
No, you got two, and then you got a bicycle. It's fine.
That could be. Maybe he's looking for a set.
Do those kryptonite locks work on the unicycle?
Oh, boy.
Where were we?
We were
Where
trying
are
to
we?
Wrap it up
yeah.
nicely before I insulted everyone.
What happened? So should I try wrapping it up yet again?
Yes, please.
Yes, we'll be in this time.
Thanks for showing up. See you later. Bye. I think I squeezed that one out.
Yes, well done. All right.
K-Stot's still there?
he's trying to see if he can get a plane ticket after losing all his money in Reno.
Oh, hello. Hello.
Dang.
He's even on West Coast time.
Yeah.
I know. I'm
just take over and wrap it up.
I am beat.
All right. Okay. I'm going to hang up on y'all.
Okay.
Wait, you don't want to wrap up then at all? That's fine.
I think we've wrapped up like three times. One of those is going to have to work.
We're wrapping up?
Yes. Okay.
Oh. One of these is going to work.
All right. Good night.
All right. Good night. Good
night.
Thanks. I'll be the one that doesn't sound American and doesn't own a gun.
You don't own a gun yet? Don't say that on the air. People will come and rob you.
Well, I can't get one until I get my green card. I don't get a gun license.
Well, you can't get one legally, but come on, no one has a legal gun around here. Here's what you do. You go to the 7-Eleven. You've got a 7-Eleven near you.
Okay. Yeah, because, you know, I joined the Microsoft Credit Union, so that's where I take my money out.
Okay, well, you go to the 7-Eleven and you just say, I'd like a gun. And they'll take it from there. They know what to do.
I thought you could shop for guns in Walmart.
Well, Walmart's okay, but 7-Eleven's quicker.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Yeah. There's none of that pesky waiting period nonsense.
Right, right. Yeah, they'll take you through it. So.
Yeah.